As we celebrate the 35th anniversary of the Clean Water Act, we still have considerable distance to travel toward achieving its goals. Increasingly, the challenges involve how and where communities grow and how best to address the impacts of land use and development on water resources. Three practitioners in this webcast will discuss how various smart growth and green infrastructure tools are being used at the regional, watershed, and site levels to preserve, enhance, and protect our water resources. Our speakers will also discuss various approaches, including messaging, research, and partnering to ensure that these tools are successfully implemented. So, let's meet our speakers. Our first speaker, Jeffrey Anderson, is the director of US EPA's Development, Community, and Environment Division. Jeff's division at the EPA is responsible for the agency's smart growth work and coordinates the Smart Growth Network. The network is a broad partnership program which encourages development that serves the economy, community, and environment. Jeff's work has included principal authorship of Why Smart Growth, a Primer, Transportation and Environmental Impacts of Brownfields versus Greenfields Development, and Transportation and Environmental Analysis of the Atlantic Steel Redevelopment, a major redevelopment in Atlanta, Georgia. Our second speaker, Nancy Stoner, is the director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Clean Water Project. Nancy has been practicing law for 20 years. She has 15 years' experience using the Clean Water Act to protect rivers, lakes, and coastal waters from contaminated stormwater, sewer overflows, agriculture, and other sources of water pollution. Nancy has been with NRDC since October 1999. From 1997 to 1999, she served as director of OECA's Office of Planning and Policy Analysis. Prior to that, she was a trial attorney with the DOJ Environment and Natural Resources Division, ENRD. Nancy holds a JD from Yale University Law School and a BA from the University of Virginia. Our final speaker, Noelle McKay, is the executive director of Smart Growth Vermont. Noelle joined Smart Growth Vermont in 2005. Previously, she was the deputy director of the Stony Brook Millstone Watershed Association in New Jersey, where she built partnerships between municipal officials and environmental advocates to improve the protection of water and related ecological resources. Noelle has worked with communities to develop open space, watershed, and habitat protection plans. She has also worked with communities to implement bylaw and policy initiatives to protect water bodies, critical habitats, and viewsheds. Now that I've introduced our speakers, let's get started. Jeff, take it away.
Thank you. This is Jeff Anderson, and I head the Development Community Environment Division, which is the Smart Growth Program. And if you will join me in flipping to slide two, you'll see the title of my talk, Smart Growth, Protecting Water at the Regional, Region, Neighborhood, and Site Level. And I'm very excited to be on this webcast and conference call. And I just want to give a couple pieces of context for you. One is that I have a lot to say in a very short time. So my remarks are going to be, I think, general in order to make very specific points. It's going to leave out some nuance that if we had, you know, an hour to talk about this, that I would definitely include. So everyone, I think, will be able to think of exceptions to the overall points I'm making, but I think they hold nonetheless. The second is that I am going to go through about 43 slides in 20 minutes, so keep your hand on your advance button and move with me now to slide three. I just want to review quickly where we stand and what's been the recent trends in terms of development patterns and rates of growth. And if you look across the country, you can see a very similar pattern playing out, and that is that growth has been very land consumptive. It's rapidly outpaced population growth, so each new person in a region or a metropolitan area tends to use more land than the previous people did. And land consumption really isn't just a function of population growth. It's a separate phenomenon, and if land consumption grew at the same rate of population growth, you would actually have a much lower rate of land consumption. You can see a similar trend in vehicle miles of travel, which, of course, has implications for water as well in terms of air deposition and in terms of pollutants that are deposited on the road during the driving that we all do every day. And you can see, for instance, between 1960 and 1990, 1970 and 1970 we had about 1 trillion miles of vehicle travel. By 1990 that had reached about 2 trillion. And again, it doesn't track very well with population growth. population grew about 27% in that time frame. There are many reasons for the increases in vehicle travel, some having to do with economics, some having to do with more women entering the workplace, but some of it definitely having to do with the way we build our communities and basically providing one viable option for getting from place to place, and that's driving. You can look at how some of these play out, and if you move to slide 5, you'll see these. This is a representation of the developed area in Charleston, South Carolina. In 1973, there were roughly 45,000 acres developed. If you move to slide 6, you can see that from 1973 to 94, population grew by about just under 50%, but the urban area expanded by 250%. And then if you project that out on slide 7, you can see that just projecting that same trend in the future will lead to an increase of urban area expansion by 250%, and that that gives you a total of 550,000 acres of development. And if you think about the water bodies in that area as basically big puddles at the bottom of a bigger hill, or, you know, the receiving bodies in watershed areas, you can tell that what happens on the hill is going to have a big impact on what happens in the in those water bodies. This is just a quick review for everyone of the impacts of different development trends, and people, I think, are going to be relatively familiar with this. The more development you have, and we're on slide 8 now, the more development you have, the less water actually percolates into the soil, and the more water runs off, the less evapotranspiration you get, and the more you have large spikes of runoff from any given rain event. And that kind of runoff, runoff from developed areas, is a major contributor to estuarine, river, and lake pollution, as well as ocean and shorelines. If you go to slide 9, you can see that I'm going to give you a time series here between 1982 and 1997, where on slide 9 you can see the percentage of areas that were in impervious surface or developed land. And anyone familiar with the Center for Watershed Protection graphs knows that at around 10%, you start to see impervious levels that begin to damage the waterways in those watershed areas. And as you move up to 25%, you get more significant damage. So bear in mind the development patterns we just reviewed as we move to slide 10 in 1997, and you can see the rapid increases in imperviousness. So this pattern of developing in a very spread out land consumptive fashion, where we put housing in one place and retail in a second and schools in a third and office in a fourth, and then basically drive around between them, has had implications with respect to land development patterns and their associated watersheds and ecosystems. On slide 11, you can see the percent of impaired water bodies, where before we were looking at imperviousness, now we're looking at impairment, and we can see that in many areas that's a real challenge. And that if we fail to address the phenomenon of development patterns, we're going to have a very, very difficult time meeting the goals set forth for EPA under the Clean Water Act of fishable, swimmable waters. And, you know, in many ways, more importantly, communities are going to have a hard time meeting the goals they have for safe drinking water and for the things they care about in living on a day-to-day basis. If you move to slide 12, I wanted to kind of give a quick overview of what smart growth is, and there's a lot to say about that. But essentially, if you think, there are kind of two ways to think about it. One is the outcomes basis, and I really think the best way to think about smart growth is to think about the development and whether you can think about a development in terms of the following criteria: its economic impact, its environmental impact, and social and community impact. And if you can give me a development and I can sort of formulate a way to change that development around to get better economic, community, and environmental impacts, well, that's going to be smarter than the former development. So I think it isn't a 0-1 scale. I think it's an incremental improvement, and we can keep trying to think of different scenarios and different ways to grow that improve our performance in each of those areas. The other way to think about it, which is sort of a less esoteric way, is to really think about how we build communities. And the fact that for the last 50 or 60 years, we've tended to build in taking the elements of community, our houses, our schools, our churches, our places of work, and sort of segmenting them into pods of development. And smart growth basically tries to take the elements of community and reintegrate them into something we used to call neighborhood. So if you move to slide 13, you can see sort of on a more regional scale, this is what current development looks like. It's rapidly consumed land. It tends to be large lot zoning. It's fairly auto-dependent, with that being really the only practical means of getting around. And it has more pollution than imperviousness impervious surface per person. Contrasting that with a more compact, more smart growth style, you have more, frankly, of a village concept there, but still with some other housing choices for people who don't want to be in a village setting. So you do more infill, you concentrate development and leave open spaces to perform their natural functions. You mix uses to create transportation choices so that some destinations are reachable by walking or bicycle or mass transit in a larger community. I'm going to move to slide 15 now, where you can see Arlington, Virginia, and this is sort of an interesting example of smart growth at the corridor level. Things to notice here that are important are the concentration of high-density development around major public infrastructure investments. You have the Metro Rail running down the center spine of Arlington, and they've concentrated a lot of high-rise development, a lot of mixed-use development, condo development, office development, et cetera. You quickly move out from that into lower-density areas. And so what you see here is a coordination of the land use and the transportation infrastructure. You see a variety of housing choices where people who have families and want yards live, in single-family houses on larger lots, and people who want to live right where the action is, young people or older people for whom services or cultural amenities are more important, they live right in the corridor. The unusual thing in this slide, though, is that the people who have the yard and the bigger house and so forth, they can actually walk or bike or take transit to very nearby destinations. And typically, that's not possible if you're looking for that kind of housing type. So in some ways, they get the best of both worlds. They can reach amenities and cultural services. Because the higher density in the corridor area supports those. By themselves, the low-density zoning, the lower-density housing, the dispersed housing doesn't have the critical mass to support that kind of development. And we'll talk a little more about that later. On slide 16, you can see smart growth at the neighborhood level. And this is where you can really see the pods of development on the top. Really represent the status quo with our shopping, our retail all in one place, the school separated from the houses probably by some kind of cyclone fence or grade separation or separation of housing types. And you'll notice that everyone basically has to, if they're going to go anywhere in that top half of the slide, they're going to have to go out on the arterial. And that has profound implications for the transportation infrastructure. It means that any route that anyone is going to take is relatively indirect and circuitous. Look at any of the houses, for instance, and imagine trying to get to the apartments. You go down through the collector road, out onto the arterial, up the collector road, and to the apartments. And so you've not only increased the distance, which makes the walking or bicycling options less appealing, but you've also added an element of pedestrian unfriendliness or even downright danger. There aren't necessarily many parents who would be willing to have their kids go walk out on that arterial. Contrast that with the bottom half of the slide, and you see a more integrated neighborhood where you have a mix of housing types integrated together. The school acts as an anchor for part of the community. The shopping is more in the center. It still takes advantage of the passing traffic on the arterial, but it also serves the surrounding neighborhoods. Obviously, a big contrast between the two, the top and the bottom, is also seen in the street system. This is an interconnected network of streets, and that means a couple things. One is that the routes are very direct. You can go from one place to another in a relatively straight line. Destinations are close by so that you can walk or bike there. And it also means that that people are going to be worried about traffic. And so the way that we deal with that in the smart growth neighborhood is to design the streets for appropriate residential standards, not these huge wide streets, but much more narrow streets that naturally slow the traffic where people react to the context and go relatively slow. And it doesn't really matter if you're going 15 miles an hour. If your trip is going to be very short, you still get there quickly. So you may be traveling 25, 30, 40 miles an hour on the wider streets of the subdivisions, but if your trip is much longer, the time may end up being equal to the shorter trip on a much slower traffic system. If you go to slide 17, we can start to look at some of the neighborhood characteristics, or the street level characteristics, rather. And you can see maybe a typical smart growth commercial corridor here. And what you see is a variety of transportation modes with walking, biking. Obviously, people are still going to drive. There's the transit system. You have relatively high density matching that that abundance of transit and transportation options with three and four-story buildings framing the street. You've got condos above retail. You've got maybe some live workspace. You've got a continuous wall of activity that pedestrians can enjoy. It's not broken up by parking lots, and it becomes a viable pedestrian area. It also has the on-street parking, which gives the people walking on the sidewalk a sense that they're in fact buffered from the passing cars. It makes it more pleasant to walk. The street trees provide some protection from the sun. It helps to frame the street, and the continuous shopping experience makes it interesting and viable to walk. The median also makes it possible to cross the street, which is very important for retailers who want you to shop both sides of the street. So what does this mean for water and water resources? Well, I've talked about several techniques that are associated with smart growth: compact design, transportation alternatives, reuse of brownfields, et cetera. And there are some key elements with water implications that really come out of those. So one of them, if you go to slide 19, is density. And the idea, the question of which is better. And on slide 20, we can look at a couple scenarios. And I think it's important to think about the way we typically analyze water impacts. And it frequently tends to be on the site basis. We're given a parcel to evaluate, and we say, all right, one unit leads to 20% imperviousness. Eight units leads to 65%. We know the Center for Watershed Protection says 25% is bad, and so we come to the conclusion that the 8 units per acre don't work well for water. And in many places, my experience has been that localities will zone for low density to try to protect water. Well, if you go on to the next slide, 21, you'll see that if we in fact do a more apples-to-apples comparison of how do you accommodate 8 units of growth within a region, you can see that the total runoff from those 8 units accommodated at 1 unit per acre is about 150,000 cubic feet. And you can contrast that to the to accommodating those 8 units on 1 acre, where you get 39,000 cubic feet. Or you can measure it on a per house accommodated, and you get 18,000 cubic feet for the low density scenario and only 5,000 or so for the high density scenario. So looking at density differently can be important from a water perspective. Slide 22 just gives you a quick sense for what 8 to 10 units per acre looks like. Slide 23 starts to take this up at the more watershed level, and this is really an extension of an idea that's familiar, I think, to people working in water, and that is that we like clustering the development. We like to save the open space on a site and try to get all the development and imperviousness in one area to use the land more efficiently. The same applies at the watershed level, and that's what you see on slide 23. Accommodating 10,000 units in a 10,000-acre watershed looks very different when you accommodate it at 1 unit per acre versus 8. And obviously the 8 units per acre keeps you under the 10% threshold even compared to the 1 unit per acre, which puts you up at 20%. The invariable question on slide 24, what happens if the whole watershed is built out? And we can take a look at that. And on slide 25 and then slide 26, we can see, all right, let's imagine the whole watershed is built out. It's not a good scenario. You get 80,000 houses in the high-density scenario on the 10,000 acres, whereas you have the 10,000 on the 10,000 acres. But that's starting to confuse what we're comparing. And I think the situation in most communities is that you're trying to figure out how to accommodate future growth. And you're not deciding between 80 and 10,000. You're saying we're expecting 80,000 units of housing over the next 20 years. How do we accommodate it? So if you go to slide 27, you can see what happens. If you accommodate it in a low-density scenario, you're building out 8 sub-watershed areas of a larger watershed and only 1 for the higher density. Now, do I like either of these scenarios? Of course not. We'd rather see land used efficiently, open space that needs to be preserved, and so forth. But as I said at the beginning, this is just sort of a gross comparison between different densities to get people to think differently about how we imagine density's impact on water. So on slide 28, I want to move down to the neighborhood level, moving away from the regional level, and discuss some of the implications of these kinds of different development styles here. Going to slide 29, I'm going to give you a comparison of a more smart growth development on a parcel of land and show you on slide 30 the same number of units and the same mix of retail and so forth on that same piece of land. Obviously, this is an application at the site level of what we just talked about at the regional level. The one scenario uses up the entire parcel of land. The other actually uses a very small portion of it. And this has further implications. If you go to slide 31, this is trying to illustrate what slide 30 might have looked like. This is the low-density, auto-oriented, pod-driven development. So this is the transportation system that goes along with that. On the next slide, you see the transportation system that's more likely associated with the smart growth scenario. On slide 33, you see the retail. This is the retail. When you spread the houses out and make them very low density, none of those places have sufficient number of customers in the small enough area to support retail. And where are those customers gathered? They're conveniently gathered on the big arterials because, as we saw in the earlier slides, everyone has to get on the arterial. So when you gather all the customers there, retail knows what to do. They put their stores there. So we shouldn't be surprised when we get strip development. If you go to slide 34, when you gather customers in a more compact way, retail can respond in a different way as well. Slide 35, the residential that often ends up looking something like this for our lower density scenario, and we're finding that some people are saying this product may in fact now be overbuilt, and that people are looking more for what's on slide 36, which is again a more compact village-like setting, even though in this case it's in a greenfield, and this project in fact sold extremely well. I think it was the top-selling project in 16 states. On slide 37, I just wanted to connect the dots a little more and show that the lower density housing, which you may evaluate on a site level basis, we should never forget that the infrastructure, housing doesn't exist in a vacuum. Those people go to work, those people go shopping, those people have kids that go to school. And the infrastructure that supports the housing on the left-hand side of the screen on slide 37 is often, turns out, the way it is on the right-hand side of the screen. And the two are indelibly interlinked and mutually support one another. On slide 38, I want to move down to the site level and just talk about a couple examples of smart growth applied at the site level. On slide 39, you'll see the example of Meisner Park. They took a dead mall and redeveloped it. It's a 29-acre site. It was 100% impervious cover. Once it was redeveloped into a higher-intensity development with 272 apartments and office and retail and so forth. And it actually, the redevelopment decreased the impervious cover by 15%. On the next slide, you'll see a similar redevelopment. It was public housing with roughly 855 units. It was redesigned as a mixed-use development with 1,200 units of housing, with retail, daycare, and so forth. They narrowed some of the streets. They replaced some with walkways, and they actually, despite the increase in density, they actually decreased the amount of runoff coming from that site. On slide 41, you see Portland, Oregon, and some of the street treatments they've given, and I'm not going to say much about this because I think Nancy Stoner is going to talk more about some of these techniques. On slide 42, you can just see some of the features associated with the smart growth neighborhoods, with the narrower streets, with the innovative use of parking, with the tree bulbs out to slow the traffic, all site design techniques that have very specific and generally good implications for water. And I want to wrap up with just a quick example of a real-life project that employed all of these techniques, and this is the Atlantic Station site. And what we did there is we looked at the impact of the 138-acre development going on to the Atlantic Station site downtown on a brownfield versus going to three other sites in the region, all of which were greenfield sites. And if you go to slide 45, you can see the comparison of the impacts. By redeveloping the brownfield, you actually reduce the volume of water runoff, you reduce the total suspended solids, you reduce the phosphorus and nitrogen, what slide 45 is showing you the comparison between Atlantic Station and the runoff generated from that, and the runoff generated from a greenfield site. And the greenfield site, the key to this is that to accommodate the roughly 10 million square feet of commercial and retail on the greenfield site and the 5,000 units of housing on the greenfield site, you would need about 1,200 acres of land. Atlantic Station did it on 138 acres. In addition, because it was a $4 billion project, they were able to use a lot of the money or some of the money to separate the stormwater from the sanitary sewer system. They cleaned up the brownfield site, and they actually improved the stormwater management from the site compared to its situation previous to redevelopment. And slide 46 shows you an example of what Atlantic Station is looking like at about 50% build-out. And with that, I'd like to conclude, and I will, I think we'll hand it over to Nancy Stoner.
Thank you, Jeff. We will pause here briefly to take some questions, and we'll begin with those submitted online. Just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on that question mark button at the top of the slides page. Our first question comes from Carl in Pennsylvania, and Carl asks, I am concerned with the narrower street and radii of curvature where that will be sufficient for emergency vehicles, i.e. fire trucks. Also, when the residents are entertaining, there will be a lot of parked cars on the roads that may tend to limit accessibility to emergency vehicles. How can emergency vehicle access be addressed?
Carl, thank you for your question. This is a great question, and it's absolutely a legitimate issue. I would start off by saying there are some areas where I think any practical application of these ideas, there's no disagreement between people looking to do narrower streets and emergency responders, where you can get wide agreement that a lot of the street standards, the 36-foot wide street and so forth, are actually wider than they currently need to be. So there's an area, I think, right now where people can agree that all needs can be met with some narrowing of streets. There are proposals for still narrower streets that cause legitimate concerns, and we've actually launched an initiative to bring together emergency response folks, bring together urban designers and transportation experts to make sure that smart growth designs actually accommodate emergency traffic. There are a couple things that are important to remember. One is the gridded street network means that a lot of places you have multiple access points to housing, to retail, and so forth. And the emergency responders like that. They really like being able to go around the block, for instance. It's very difficult for emergency responders to serve cul-de-sacs where they're longer than, say, 200 or 250 feet or so, and that takes place in many instances. So there are issues with emergency response now, and of course we've seen in California with the wildfires, just development being in places that are very hard to serve up narrow canyons in high fire areas, and I think smart growth would look to keep development out of those areas or to be more thoughtful about how to accommodate those. But there are also techniques like mid-block reinforcement of sidewalk areas so that ladder trucks, as they try to stage their trucks, will have places to put their outriggers that are capable of supporting the fire truck weight. We also have examples across the country of older cities with very narrow streets that are successfully served every day with emergency response vehicles. And some of it has to do, frankly, with the purchasing emergency response vehicles that respond to narrower streets. And for some communities it comes down to, do you want to design your streets around your emergency response vehicles, or do you want your emergency response vehicles designed around the kind of community you want?
Thank you, Jeff. Our next question comes from Jean in Pennsylvania. Regarding stormwater management and the reduction of impervious surfaces, do you see an applicability for implementation of stormwater utilities to help control impervious surfaces?
Yeah, I think stormwater utilities can be a very good tool. The question always comes down to whether you're talking about a stormwater utility or a more conventional approach to the regulation of stormwater, or to cities that are looking at unconventional approaches to dealing with stormwater or combined sewer overflows, is what are the steps that you're actually proposing to take with the stormwater utility. And so I think getting a new understanding of density is important. I think understanding imperviousness per person or per unit of development accommodated is an important concept that ought to be looked into. And as stormwater utilities think about how to measure imperviousness, that ought to be something that they really look at closely.
Okay, it looks like we have time for one more question submitted online, and that question comes from Kate in D.C. And Kate says, smart growth seems like a good idea, and places that embody smart growth principles are in demand. So why do we continue to see so much conventional low-density development?
I think there are a number of reasons for that, and they're closely intertwined. One is that you have many communities that still have regulations in place whose first adoption or implementation was the 1950s or the 1940s, and they've sort of tweaked them from there. But the conventional wisdom at that time, and I think it, you know, in many ways served the needs of that time very well, was the separation of uses, wanting to have a lot more low-density housing than was available at that time. But in many cases, a lot of America's favorite places in the Washington area, the Georgetowns, the Annapolises, Charleston, South Carolina, other places like that are simply illegal to build now. And when you're a developer trying to figure out what kind of development you're going to do, it's not a very appealing idea to try to go through and get all kinds of variances, not knowing whether you'll actually get those accepted at the end. And so the development community often will go ahead and do the thing that they've done before, and they know they have precedent for doing, and they know they can get through. There's also some barriers, I think, in the private sector of not really having a lot of experience building this kind of product anymore. And that's changing, and you're actually seeing that the private sector, where they are responding and bringing new product on the market, as you said, they're actually selling very well and becoming very expensive. And, of course, the answer to that in a market economy is to provide more product, not discard it as only for the wealthy, because these aren't inherently expensive to build, but when there are a small number of them available on the market, then the demand gets bid up and they become expensive. So I think you're going to start to see more changes. The demographics, the energy situation that we find ourselves in, people's sort of being fed up with traffic congestion, the price of oil, a number of things are going to, I think, make these kinds of developments more attractive in the future and will lead the way for a private sector to learn better how to do these developments and for the public sector to respond and make them more available.
At this time, if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before the question.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, this is Lee Epstein from Chesapeake Bay Foundation. The example that Jeff used with the public housing conversion showed an increase in the housing that's provided, but I'm most of the examples I ever see where there is a redesign and neo-traditional and smart growth type community is used, those housing numbers usually go down, and that's a problem. I wonder if there's a comment to that.
Thanks for your question, Lee. I'm familiar with a couple examples as well of redesigns, and we actually gave two smart growth awards to redesigns of public housing projects this year. One to High Point in Seattle, and another to a project New Columbia in Portland, Oregon, and both of those not only increased the total number of houses on site just in pure totals, but they also increased the number of affordable units on site. So I think that, it's hard to sort of comment on that general trend. without sort of knowing a specific situation. But obviously from the water perspective and from the environment perspective, I think when you're reusing a site, the more efficiently you can reuse it, the more units that you can accommodate on that site, obviously the less runoff per unit, the more opportunities there are for a mix of housing types, the more opportunities there are to support local retail. And so I think we need to be, to really make sure you're getting an environmental benefit out of it. I think you have to look at that.
At this time, we will move on to the next session. So, Nancy Stoner, if you could please unmute yourself and take it away.
Okay. Hi, everyone. This is Nancy Stoner from the Natural Resources Defense Council's Clean Water Project. And I first just want to say that I'm delighted to be a part of this webcast today and to be able to talk about how smart growth and green infrastructure interrelate and are complementary strategies for protecting water resources. I looked at the list of all the people on the webcast today who signed up for it, and I know that a lot of you are experts. A lot of you come from these areas in which green infrastructure approaches have been piloted or are part of your water protection system there. And so I'm sorry that I don't have the opportunity to actually learn from you in the webcast as well. But I'd appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. So I'm going to start on slide 48, which is a picture of original green infrastructure. So this is the ideal, really. This is how the environment looks and functions before it's developed. And the goal of green infrastructure, basically, is to try to mimic those natural functions as much as possible. Jeff earlier went over on slide 8 some of the impacts of development on water bodies. The main ones for purposes here are that we're removing the natural vegetation, so we're losing the water quality benefits associated with that soil and vegetation. He mentioned evapotranspiration and so forth that we get from that, filtration as well. And then what we're replacing it with, of course, is hardscape, with pavement, with rooftops, all of which traps water on the surface, picks up all of the pollution from society, that basically the toxic muck that we all leave, the trash and so forth, on the surface of the earth, carries it to the waterways, also increases the volume and the velocity, causing scouring, causing stream bank erosion and loss of riparian habitat. So on slide 49, the basic functions that we get that we're losing through that uncontrolled development, we get more flooding, the water has nowhere to go. We get those water quality problems that we talked about, from everything on the streets, on the rooftops, the fertilizers, the pesticides, the pet waste, all those things that are carried into the waterways. We're interfering with groundwater recharge, and so there's less water available for water supply from the groundwater, and also the interference with the base flow in the rivers interferes with that freshwater supply from the surface waters as well. Instead, the stormwater pipes are carrying the stormwater out to the coast where it's no longer available for water supply. And then we lose the habitat, both the areas that are directly impacted by development and those indirectly impacted, like those riparian areas that are blown out that I mentioned already. Moving on to slide 50. So what is it that we're trying to achieve? What is a healthy watershed? We want to have healthy riparian areas. We want to have those connected with upland habitats. We want to have the waterway be able to respond to flood events, or sort of a more positive way of putting it. We want to have stable hydrology, replicate the pre-development hydrology as much as possible. We want to have the watershed be able to absorb the pollutant inputs that it will receive from the developed environment. So we want to have pollution sinks, the soil and vegetation, the wetlands, and so forth. And then we want to have the watershed be able to respond to all the range of inputs, the flow, the velocity, and the pollution. So that's what we're trying, you're shooting for in the developed watershed, as much as possible. Going on to slide 51, green infrastructure has many definitions, but one is using trees and other vegetation in urban, or I would add suburban, areas to manage and treat precipitation naturally rather than collecting it in pipes. It uses engineered systems, green roofs, rain gardens, and vegetated swales. As I mentioned, the idea is to mimic natural functions. It's often accompanied by approaches that capture and reuse stormwater and wastewater, rain barrels, cisterns, and so forth that are not themselves green soil and vegetation, but also reduce water use, also prevent off-site runoff. And moving on to slide 52. So some of the benefits of green infrastructure, they reduce sewer overflows. This is primarily in combined sewer systems by offloading the stormwater from the system, filtering the polluted stormwater, recharging the groundwater, reducing the heat island effect, improving air quality, providing wildlife habitat and recreational space, protecting the stream banks, reducing energy usage, preventing flooding, improving urban aesthetics, increasing property and community values, as Jeff was emphasizing as well, and it's often less expensive than conventional approaches. This is a picture of a rain garden here from Maplewood, Minnesota. Obviously very beautiful as well as functional. So focusing on the three different scales that we're attempting to cover in this presentation today. So on the regional scale, the idea is to ensure that there's a functioning watershed and ecosystem, green corridors surrounding the development core that Jeff was just talking about. These two, as I said, are complementary. The idea is to have dense development in urban areas near transit and so forth, and then to also protect the green corridors outside the urban area that can help provide these functions. On the neighborhood and sub-watershed level, green infrastructure can be used to restore impaired streams, replenish the groundwater, protect the surface waters that are used, source waters that are used for drinking, reducing combined sewer overflows, and often the model, as Jeff mentioned, is compact development, using portions of a site for stormwater and wastewater controls. And then at the site level, trying to maintain the pre-development hydrology on that site, focusing on the pollutants of concern at that site and trying to retain them on site and allow them to infiltrate into the soil, filtering out those pollutants. And the key there is to use is multifunctionality, is using every inch of the site possible to perform these functions, not lowering the density, but rather using the site more effectively. And going on to some examples here. So I've got a number of examples from different different levels. The first one has to do with the first couple have to do with the Chicago area in Cook County, Illinois. They have set up a forest preserve district there. The idea is to have they did some intensive mapping of forest lands and preserving forest lands. And the numbers here are the numbers that indicate the estimates that they have made of the amount of value that they would get from doing these essentially green corridors outside the urban area, 40% runoff reduction, and aquifer and lake recharge equivalent to additional supply for more than 1 million people. Going on to slide 55, in Chicago. Now, Chicago, of course, is one of the key examples. They are doing a lot of these different kinds of green infrastructure approaches, and they are one of the communities that are covered in Rooftops to Rivers, which is a report that NRDC did about a year ago. And I realized that I never mentioned it anywhere in this slide, so I thought in the presentation, so I thought I should mention it. It is on our website, nrdc.org. It's called Rooftops to Rivers, Green Strategies for Controlling Stormwater and Combined Sewer Overflows. So back to Chicago in slide 55. So they have a green roof incentive program in Chicago, providing density bonuses, providing grants to partially cover the cost. They now have more than 80 green roofs covering over 1 million square feet. A 2003 study found that green roof runoff volume was less than half of that of conventional roofs. They also have a subsidized rain barrel program that they're using in a focused area to reduce flooding, basement flooding in certain areas. and a downspout disconnection program that is projected to reduce combined sewer overflow peak flow in target areas by 20%. Downspout disconnection is often a relatively inexpensive approach. Where there's sufficient space, it's often, very, as I said, very inexpensive and can really take a lot of the stormwater out of the combined system, saving a lot of money in contrast to building underground storage or surface reservoirs. The next slide, 56, is showing the green bungalows in Chicago. These are both energy efficient and water efficient. And one of the things that that you get from using green infrastructure is mentioned in the first bullet, which is about the green roofs. The average temperature is 10 to 15 degrees lower than a black tar roof, which not only reduces the temperature, reduces the runoff, also saves money. The next slide, 57, is another regional program. This is the Milwaukee Green Seams program. The numbers on the left have to do with how much land has been purchased. Again, Milwaukee looked at a watershed-wide basis, recognized that their investments could be more, achieve more if they didn't just focus on hard infrastructure within the city, but also preserving green space through voluntary sales of property outside the city. They focused on riparian areas, floodplains, areas that could provide stormwater management, and they have stored enough water to remove 2,000 homes from the floodplain that were previously getting flooded. I just can't talk as fast as Jeff Anderson, I'll tell you that. Moving on to page 58 on Portland, looking at the community level there, first they have a city code that requires on-site stormwater management for both new development and redevelopment. So the idea there, which is one that I think is really important, is to make sure that as new development occurs within the city and redevelopment occurs within the city, that the best stormwater approaches are used at that time because it is less expensive than it is to retrofit facilities later to put in stormwater management controls. That's definitely the most cost-effective way to do it. They also have a downspout disconnection program. As I mentioned, those are very effective, cost-effective programs. In Portland, they'll either disconnect your downspout for you or they'll give you $53 to do it yourself. And that has taken about 1 billion gallons of rainwater out of the system. Moving on to slide 60 on Portland still, they have a zoning bonus for green roofs, and they also now have a credit on the stormwater fee of up to 35% for on-site stormwater management. These are good ways to leverage private investment into green infrastructure. The green roofs in Portland, they retain about 58% of annual rainfall and nearly 100% of warm season rainfall. And an interesting, relatively recent finding is they did modeling of 300 blocks and found that green roofs actually, the greatest benefit actually didn't have anything to do with water resources, but it was a human health benefit due to heat island mitigation and associated illnesses, deaths associated with heat. Moving on to the neighborhood levels in Portland on 59. Again, these are vegetated curve extensions. Jeff showed a picture of those earlier in his presentation. They are very consistent with the kinds of traffic calming kinds of things that he was talking about. But here the street edge alternatives are used also for stormwater retention infiltration. This is an area that's in the combined sewer system. And they have 88% reduction of peak flow and 85% reduction of inflow into the combined sewer system for a 25-year storm event. Obviously, reducing those combined sewer overflow discharges of raw sewage are of critical importance to the water bodies. They also help protect local basements from flooding. They're relatively inexpensive. They're very popular also among the people who live in these neighborhoods. Moving on to Seattle, page 61, This is a similar kind of concept there. These are bioretention swales. These are among the most effective of any green infrastructure demonstration projects that I've seen. They've reduced the runoff by 99%. They actually have had no measured runoff since December of 2002. They're called Street Edge Alternatives in Seattle. And then at the site level, slide 62 is the King Street Center in Seattle. And there they have over 16,000 gallons of storage that it's used to flush toilets and for irrigation. Obviously, one of the greatest inefficiencies we have in this country is that we use tap water to flush toilets. And that it appears to be changing at a rather slow rate, but it's interesting that buildings are now focusing on that as a way of saving water conservation. Moving on to 63 and High Point, Jeff mentioned this development project as an award winner in Seattle. There's two slides on it. The first one gives sort of the basics of what it looks like, this infill project. It's a Hope 6 project of relatively high density, yet it still has 65% reduction of stormwater into the receiving waters. And each block has site-specific drainage strategies that are depicted in more detail on slide 64. And that really has too much information on it for me to go through in much depth. But the idea is again, to use every space, the sidewalks, to use the streets, to use, forest concrete, to use yard drains. They've got pipes going underneath with these stormwater pop-ups. They're using all of the available space around this relatively dense development in order to capture stormwater on site. Moving to slide 65 on Toronto. This is a slide about a study that Ryerson University did, and they looked at what would be the impacts of installing green roofs on all city roofs of greater than 3750 square feet. And what they were looking at primarily was cost savings associated with that. So the top pie there is initial savings or capital costs associated with avoided capital costs associated with this. And then the bottom pie is the annual savings. And the assumption made was that the city wasn't paying for the green roofs there, but this is if these green roofs were installed through leveraging private investment, how much money would the city save? And the total estimate was $270 million in capital cost savings and more than $30 million in annual savings. Slide 66 is another study. This is one here in Washington, D.C., at the community level by an organization called Casey Trees. It's an urban forestry group. This was funded by EPA, and it's actually currently in its second phase. But this is the results from the first phase, which looked at three different types of green infrastructure approaches. Green roofs, putting in more trees, improving tree coverage in the city, and then larger tree boxes. And just those three different approaches were found to reduce discharges of untreated sewage and storm water into the waterways by 1.1 billion gallons, reducing CSO volume by 22% and the frequency of overflows by 6.7. And then one thing that's important for targeting is that it actually, this study broke apart the different sewer sheds and found that in those that were the most impervious, these three techniques could reduce the discharge volumes by up to 27%. So there's a second phase of the study now going on looking at other different types of green infrastructure or low-impact development approaches. And then another study that came out also last spring is the next one, 67. The Hudson Riverkeeper did a study called Sustainable Raindrops. And this was looking at New York City's investments. You know, one of the main drivers for green infrastructure, in my mind anyway, is the huge costs associated with centralized combined sewer overflow controls. And what the Hudson Riverkeeper did is look at what would happen if 50% of the $2.1 billion projected costs for green infrastructure were spent instead on rain gardens, street trees, green roofs, and rain barrels, and also street edge alternatives. And that they found that they would capture an additional 1 billion gallons of the combined sewer overflow, reduce the annual treatment cost by 50%, and reduce air pollution, including 3,000 tons of carbon dioxide. And that study is up on their website. And then, you know, one of the famous new examples of a site-level design in obviously a very urban area in New York City in Battery Park is the Solaire, which is a LEED Gold building. It has a rooftop garden, and they capture storage rainwater for roof irrigation. They also have in-building wastewater treatment. They actually have black water treatment and reuse there for cooling water and for toilet flushing. And they use 50% less potable water than comparable buildings. And of course, it's a very desirable place to live for a lot of reasons, and sells 4 to 5% above market. I also just wanted to mention at least briefly that we, NRDC, recently put out a report called In Hot Water on water resource impacts from global warming. And the picture there shows the loss of snowpack in the Kot Cascades. Probably a lot of these are familiar to people, reduction in snowpack, sea level rise, more frequent large storm events, more frequent droughts, and loss of cold water fisheries. And the reason I bring that up here is shown in slide 60. To me, the implications of it, you know, all signs point in the direction of green infrastructure. To me, climate change also points in that direction, because a lot of what we do for water resources using green infrastructure is also good for climate. The graph on page 70 is the urban heat island profile. Obviously, the peak heat areas are in the downtown, with the pavement that reflects the heat, absorbs the heat, and as well as generates the runoff. And so in order to address that, as we do with other areas, we want to protect the space outside the city, the wetlands, the headwaters, the forests, the open space that can help absorb the heat, keep the temperatures down, and want to have green roofs, rain gardens, and other green infrastructure in urban and suburban areas, also to keep cool the temperatures, save energy, reduce the heat island effect. And then we also need to expand floodplains, stream buffers, and coastal dunes so as to provide adaptation for people to deal with the effects of climate. And then the last couple of slides here, recently NRDC and several other organizations joined with US EPA in a statement of intent to promote the use of green infrastructure to control sewer overflows and stormwater pollution. That was last April, and there's now a green infrastructure strategy under development with those organizations. There's actually a statement of support that anyone can sign onto on EPA's new green infrastructure website, which is a wonderful website that I really encourage you to look at. It has a lot of information, not just about case studies, but also about models that you can use to evaluate what green infrastructure can do in your community. Really has excellent information available. And as I said, you can sign on to support, find out about conferences, because there's a lot of conferences coming up on this topic, and how you could learn from others. And that's all I have. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nancy. If I could get everyone to please move with me to slide number 72. We will pause briefly here to take some questions, beginning with those submitted online. Just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on that question mark button at the top of the slides page. Our first question comes from R.E. in Pennsylvania, and the question is, I am part of a watershed association in southeast Pennsylvania that occupies 143 square miles and discharges to the Delaware River. We have lots of suburban growth extending from Philadelphia. With many municipalities all looking at their fair share of land development, it is difficult to implement smart growth. What options are there to get municipalities to work together towards smart growth?
Well, that's a really good question, although I think I'm, to some extent, the wrong recipient of the question because I'm the least knowledgeable about smart growth of the three panelists here. But I think that there are, I think there are challenges both with smart growth and with green infrastructure in the way that our institutions are divided. Not only are they divided, as the question suggests, you know, one county versus another county, but also within the county structure, often the planning group is separate from the stormwater group, is separate from the folks who are building roads and so forth. And so I think that, having watershed-wide approaches and having structures that support those are very important. I don't know myself of a lot of examples of where that has been done. There are a few I know from areas in the Midwest. I mentioned earlier when I was talking about the work that has been done to identify green corridors. There's a group that's working in Wisconsin and Illinois and Indiana, I believe, to identify green corridors. And those are sort of superimposed on the government. It's like, interstate basins on those kinds of things. And I think that those kinds of organizations and MOUs, like the Delaware River Water Basin, structures that need to be reflected in the laws as well as among MOUs and other private agreements among entities. I actually think that departments of environmental resources or departments of the environment are also structures that can be helpful, at least within entities like counties and cities, to integrate these functions.
Thank you, Nancy. I also heard right here in headquarters that Noelle's section of the presentation might actually help a little bit with the implementation questions. So perhaps you'll get more information through that. Our next question comes from Dan in Wyoming, and the question is, there is much concern with non-point source water pollution from urban runoff. Many of the suggestions in this presentation appear to provide a direct vector for such pollution to enter groundwater reserves. How can water managers reduce this risk?
Well, and that's a very good question, and it does come up. And particularly it comes up in brownfields redevelopment. There are situations in which it isn't appropriate to infiltrate groundwater because of the level of contamination. That doesn't always mean that green infrastructure or low-impact development approaches can't be used. Sometimes there's just a need to do lining and other kinds of ways of trapping the water. But you do lose some of the benefit of it if you can't use groundwater recharge as part of your strategy. But for most areas that are not heavily contaminated, like a brownfield, structures can be designed in ways so that they're not contaminating the groundwater, but rather using the soil and the vegetation and the biotic processes to remove the bulk of the contamination, and so that it actually helps replenish those groundwater resources with naturally filtered stormwater.
Thank you, Nancy. And at this time, if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, I ask that you please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before the question.
Love that. That's awesome.
Are there any questions from the phone line?
Hi, my name is Nate Cormier.
Go ahead with your question, Nate.
Hi, I'm at SBR Design in Seattle, and we were the firm that worked on the High Point project. We did the natural drainage system work there.
Hey, thank you.
And I wanted to share another resource that a number of us who are practitioners and advocates of green infrastructure are using. We've developed a wiki where we can post case studies and lessons learned and help refine the definitions of green infrastructure. It's a term that emerged initially out of the conservation community, but the planning, design, and engineering fields are kind of adding more layers to the story. So I wanted to just give a website for folks, greeninfrastructurewiki.com, and invite you guys to join as collaborators in sharing what you've learned.
That's great. Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to mute everyone, and we're going to go and take some more questions from those submitted online just because it's getting kind of hard to hear. So please, again, mute your phones. And our next question comes from Carl in Pennsylvania, who asks, regarding green infrastructure and marketing of the benefits, can you cite any economic studies to help to justify the implementation of green infrastructure? And again, Nancy, since I just muted everyone, you're going to have to unmute yourself.
This is a great question. This is a softball because there actually was just a document that just came out from Eco Northwest called The Economics of Low Impact Development, a Literature Review, that I just got yesterday. This was funded in part by the Waterkeeper Alliance, and it has in it a bunch of analysis of exactly those questions, including where cost savings from these approaches have benefited residential developments and commercial developments. There's also a fair amount of information in a new EPA report that maybe my EPA colleagues can tell me the name of, but it's something about the cost savings associated with low-impact development as well. I think there's actually a lot of literature on that topic, and I would hope that a lot of it is on that green infrastructure website that I gave you before on EPA's website. But there's particularly for new development, avoiding the curb and gutter and the stormwater piping associated with those new developments in the traditional models that Jeff was showing often provide a lot of cost savings. And then some of these other studies, as I mentioned, like the sustainable raindrop study, compare to hard infrastructure costs that are paid for by municipalities, therefore by the taxpayers. And so if those costs can be avoided through approaches, particularly ones that have multiple benefits, as green infrastructure often does, it's a much better investment for the community.
Thank you, Nancy. And we'll take one more question before we move on. And this question comes from Michael in New Hampshire. Michael asks, what were the actual or projected time frames or schedule to install green roofs, et cetera, versus time needed to correct CSO?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, it actually depends a lot upon what kind of approach is used. Obviously, it doesn't take 20 years to build a green roof like it takes 20 years to build a storage tunnel under a community for combined sewer systems. But it, particularly if the approach used is relying principally on people replacing green roofs at the time that they're replacing their roofs anyway, then it could take 20 years to get a significant turnover in terms of green roofs. That's why a lot of these communities are using incentives to speed up that investment, providing tax credits, tax increment financing, providing credits on stormwater, utility fees, density bonuses, other kinds of things to try to speed up the timetable. But, you know, basically I would say both of them probably take about 20 years. But in 20 years the question is, are you better off to have those green roofs and all of the energy savings, the global warming benefits, habitat enhancement, all those kinds of things, as well as the CSO reduction? Or are you better off with an underground tunnel that just provides CSO reduction?
Thank you, Nancy. And can I please get everyone to move with me to slide number 73? And just before we move on to the final session of today's presentation, I'd just like to announce that the Watershed Academy webcast team will be taking a break in December to unwind and celebrate a full year of watershed education. Don't worry, though. We'll be back in January of 2008. Please visit the Watershed Academy webcast webpage at epa.gov/watershedwebcasts for more information. And happy holidays. Okay, Noelle, at this time, if you could please unmute yourself and take it away.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit today. My experience, my background is in environmental studies and biology. I worked for 9 years in New Jersey for the Stony Brook Millstone Watershed Association on water quality and land use issues, and now I'm in Vermont working on smart growth issues. And the current organization that I'm working with, Smart Growth Vermont, is a statewide organization. So I'm going to try to give you some experience in terms of what programs that I've been part of and how I've kind of partnered and used messaging to kind of move programs forward. So in case you thought Vermont was all green pastures, we're a very small population of only about 620,000 people, and our largest city, Burlington, is about 38,000. And some people think of Vermont, they think of the rolling hills, historic villages, compact centers, and that's a really huge goal for both our organization and the state. How do we maintain that landscape that really has become a brand for Vermont and an economic brand for both products as well as tourists and people visiting us? And so the idea of maintaining our compact settlement patterns, the compact centers surrounded by working farms and forests, is a huge goal. But if, in case you thought that there was no problems, here's a picture, we're on slide 76 now, of Shelburne Road, which is in the northern part of the state. In the background you see one of our largest cities, Burlington, and that's in the 1930s. And in less than 60 years, when you see on slide 77, you'll see really the epitome of sprawl. And you see, again, what Jeff talked about is those kind of pods of development with everything having to go to that main artery, which in this case is Route 7. So we really do have the same issues that we're dealing with across the country. And as we've talked about before, which I think is really important, is land use is really connected to so much. It's connected to water quality and quantity. And so how we develop, how we grow, how we steward our land is going to be really important to the future. And I think it's important to also not move away from just water quality, but it's important to look at it in a broader scale, and I think smart growth helps to do that. And it does that by really allowing us to think of who do we partner with. So here we look at, it's also critical to factors for food production. We see a rise in the local war movement, buying local food. How do we feed ourselves if we continue to kind of gobble up all our land? We see air quality because we're all in our cars. We're looking at air quality consequences of how we develop our land. As Nancy mentioned, climate change. We're looking at air quality related to climate change. Here in Vermont, most of our air quality and greenhouse gas emissions are all related to auto transportation. We've also seen how we develop looking at and linked to human health and obesity rates. EPA has a wonderful series of slides that we use often to really showcase how we develop the land is related to other factors, including human health. Historic preservation. Here in Vermont, and I know across the country, a lot of our older cities are where our historic buildings are. And looking at maintaining that and reusing those buildings is very important in terms of smart growth. And we also think about, in terms of smart growth and land use, the economic benefits and cost savings. So the next slide is slide 79. And kind of two things that these next two slides are things that were mentioned by Jeff and Nancy, but I kind of wanted to give you some quantitative data. If you look at developing in the United States between 2000 and 2005 in two different scenarios, smart growth and sprawl, we see that you can save billions of dollars. One is in sewer and water infrastructure. If we maintain, instead of sending our sewer and pipelines out to the hinterlands, if we really concentrate our development, it's estimated that we can save about $12.6 billion. And also the same about much more in terms of $109 billion for local road infrastructure. And then finally, there'll be more development for property development costs available as well. So it's also important, you know, when I kind of talk to people, is to provide them not only environmental messaging, but also the economic benefits. And then we're looking at greenhouse gas. And slide 80 really shows in terms of energy use and output. And we're combining here the orange on this slide is household use, and the green on the slide is transportation use. And the first chart off to the left is a suburban average. So that's kind of an average home with a regular car, and we're seeing how much energy is used by that family. And you compare that to a suburban green. So in green, transportation is a hybrid, and then the household green is looking at energy savings in the house and upgrading in the house. And you can see there is a huge savings in terms of energy there. But then if you move to the next, we're looking at urban, just an average urban home. And an average urban home that is not green saves more energy than the suburban green. And then finally, you can see that you've cut your use, if you look at urban green, quite substantially. So kind of providing people with information, we do it with individuals, we also do it with communities, and we do it with the state, to help them realize that the consequences of land use has more than just environmental. There's transportation and hard costs for their community and the state, and there's also cost, other costs to the environment. So we kind of take all this information, and if we move to slide 81, what do we really do with that? How do we develop programs and partnerships and messages that really resonate with the people that are making those decisions? So moving on to 82, here in Vermont, we asked that question and worked the same way when I was in New Jersey. Where are those decisions being made? And here in Vermont, we're a statewide organization, and so we look at decisions being made at the state level first. And one of the, as I mentioned, one of the state level goals is to really maintain and enhance that traditional settlement pattern, which you can kind of see in the illustration. How do we direct most of our growth to our community centers, really enhance those centers, make them really livable places where people want to work and play, and then that really becomes the spikes for transportation alternatives. So here in Vermont, we have a history of something called our downtown program. It really is a historic preservation program, and it really started in 1998 with a group of folks coming together and saying, are our downtowns important? And how do we really preserve and incent growth in those areas? So there's a designation program for our downtowns and villages that provide incentives. But we realized, and many people here in the state realized, that that was not going to be enough. Somebody asked the question about why are we building outside? And there really is, as Jeff mentioned, a lot of economic reasons and a lot of development hurdles. And for us here, there's also a lot of public outcry or NIMBYism, because you've got more people if you're trying to develop in a more dense area already. So we looked at how do we expand that downtown program to really look at where getting communities to really think, where do you want to grow and develop in the future? Getting them to put the zoning and the infrastructure in place, and what would follow would be an easier, quicker, incentivized areas for developers to build. And that's what we call the Growth Center Program, which was signed into law last year. And in order to do that and to have a successful program, we really didn't do it alone. We had to partner with the planning folks, the housing, nonprofit housing, the developers, preservation groups, and business groups. So we looked at building a coalition first to kind of move that legislation forward. And the premise on slide 83, we really try to create a clear definition of growth centers. And for that, we really have written into the bill smart growth principles. It needs to be compact, higher density, mixture of uses, looking at transportation options. So when a community is going through the process, they need to ask themselves those questions. And there was an implementation manual that was developed along with that to really help communities as they move through the process. Again, there's a streamlined designation process that was implemented because we want to make it easier for communities to go through this process, and it provides incentives because developers really wanted a program that leveled the playing field so that it was at least as easy and as inexpensive, same price to develop in a downtown versus out in a greenfield. And we really tried to build on that, the existing base of support for the Downtown and Village Center program that was already there. And it really looked at supporting the construction of new homes. Here in Vermont, we've never had the huge highs and lows in terms of the housing industry, but we do have a shortage of housing right now. And so providing incentives for those new homes helped us bring the development community into the partnership. So on slide 84, we also looked at where else are decisions being made here in Vermont. Now, very similar to New Jersey, we've got state level, and there is regional governments, but really most of the local land use decisions being made here in Vermont are being made at the local level. So as an organization, we said, you know, how do we participate and how do we help? And those local levels are made by volunteers who often don't have planning expertise or environmental expertise or design and architectural expertise. So how do we really partner with them and help them move through the process and understand that the decisions that they make don't just have decisions to an individual landowner, but there's community implications, there's cost implications, there's water quality implications to that, and that they have options for development, that you can mix development with environmental conservation. That's really what we try to do. And for us, we do that by providing a lot of training and workshops around the state. We have, or we will have in the next month or so, an online toolbox where communities can go and get examples of smart growth, zoning ordinances, bylaws, policies that other communities around Vermont to really help them know and have a trusted resource that they can go to and say, I know that these folks have vetted this. I know that they're thinking about smart growth and how we implement that in Vermont, and I really want to quickly and easily download this and kind of massage it for my own community. And we also do some long-term assistance with communities communities that are really interested in tackling a certain issue in their community using smart growth principles and tools. We're working on programs on being with them in the long haul to kind of go through a zoning amendment, implement a new comprehensive plan, and help them kind of handhold them so that they become models for future communities. And often when, you know, working with community advocates, working with other organizations, there's a couple of different ways to kind of get your foot in the door or look at these issues. And there's those kind of traditional planning vehicles that we often work with, comprehensive plans, looking at zoning, bylaw, ordinance amendments. So often you can kind of enter that process and provide help in those traditional planning vehicles. But I think sometimes it's really important to kind of step outside the box and also look at the issues in a community and how you can take the issue and turn it around and say how we develop that land is tied to that issue. And, you know, things like historic preservation, looking at scenic road corridors or waterways are all ways to kind of enter the discussion on land use and how we use it in a new way. So if you move to slide 85, one way is historic preservation. And here in Burlington, there's a lot of discussion on rezoning and how do we kind of add density, add buildings, do redevelopment in a way that really respects the kind of traditional character. And there is a couple of historic preservation groups that were really concerned and not quite understanding what smart growth, how design plays in. And so in going to speak with them, and you'll see on slide 86, really tried to make the connection that historic preservation is smart growth. Because historic buildings are generally where you already have public infrastructure. That's where, in terms of economics, you can help a town see that taking a vacant or underused building, adding apartments up above, retrofitting it so you can have offices or retail, also saves land, but also generates tax assets for the community that really kind of pay back year after year. Most of our historic buildings are in downtowns, and you've got that pedestrian rather than automobile orientation. And in generally, our neighborhoods, you know, old neighborhoods had that mixture of uses. As Jeff said, you know, a lot of what we're seeing, you know, happened in the 50s and 60s where we started to do that kind of pod development. But if we look at where our kind of historic neighborhoods are, a lot of the smart growth principles are already there. And if you move to slide 87, also in terms of jobs and economics, if you rehab a building, generally the labor is local and the materials come from out of state. So if you do rehab, there's 60 to 70% of the budget is generally for labor versus if you're doing new construction, it's 50. So that's new jobs in the community where people can kind of, they're getting income and they're also spending their money locally, which is important. And if you're looking at preservation versus demolition, reduces construction waste, you know, reuses existing resources, and again, no new land is consumed. So by entering the discussion on zoning and planning and kind of partnering with a preservation and helping kind of get that messaging that what they're doing and what they're concerned about really is smart growth, is a way to garner support and look at an issue in a fresh way. If you go to slide 88, in terms of working locally, some of the things that have worked for me is really respecting the local process. When you, wherever you're at, if you're at a regional organization or a local organization, you know, how you want to advocate and how your organization wants to advocate and participate in these discussions really needs to be carefully thought out. There's a whole spectrum of how folks advocate, and you know, you can be more of the hard edge organizations that are really looking at legal action. You can be you know, very soft and just research based. You can be an organization that wants to bring people into the discussion and kind of be the mediator or facilitator. I think it's important when you're developing programs is really determining where you want to be on that spectrum. And then also thinking about how do you want to partner with the groups on the other aspects of the spectrum that might have similar goals, and kind of moving those goals forward in a very orchestrated way. And here in Vermont, we've got a group called the Smart Growth Collaborative that has environmental, business groups, bike pedestrian groups, historic preservation groups that kind of work together. And one group might play the far left, one group might play the far right, and another group might play the middle. But we're very orchestrated in how we do that. And in terms of working with the local process, it's really important to kind of respect that. These are folks that are volunteers, they're not trained on the issue, and in developing the programs both in New Jersey and here in Vermont, we always asked ourselves, how would we want to be treated in those situations? And if you ask the local folks, what are your goals for your town, you're not going to get, you know, I'd like to see sprawl and poor water quality. People, you know, say to you, you know, I want to preserve my local, my rural heritage. We want clean water. So once you have those goals, and they're their goals, they've owned them, then you can kind of say, well, how are you implementing those goals? And looking at ways to kind of gently suggest and guide how they can improve that local implementation to move them more successfully towards their goals. And as a resource, you can kind of move that forward, your agenda forward through them in a way that becomes more of a partnership than an advocate. One thing that's always been really helpful is to provide examples, education, and really looking at visuals. And the visual can be out in the real world or it can be through slides. And I think, as I mentioned before, it's really important sometimes to look in your community and who are some of the likely partners that you always partner with, but also who are some of those unlikely folks that you might not think about partnering with. And in terms of kind of sparking interest, if you move to slide 89, we're looking at, you know, getting people out. So taking people out on tours of the rivers, lakes, and streams. Did that in a community in New Jersey. They had never been seen their community from the water perspective and took their planning staff out on a canoe trip. And it really changed how they looked at that kind of resource in their community, kind of creating that spark and getting people to think about the assets that they have in their community, how they can protect it and integrate it into their planning process. If you move to slide 90, this is a series of four slides that have been I've used really effectively to kind of show that the community has options. So slide 90 shows a community, fairly rural community, no sewer and water. It's all they're looking at septics and wells. And this community, as many communities are challenged with, they've got growth, They need to have it happen, but they really want to maintain their rural character. So moving to slide 91, you see this is the conventional zoning, and you see generally that, you know, 5 to 10 acres up in the top right, and then, you know, maybe some 1 to 2 acres on the rest of it. But by having this conventional zoning built out, you basically eliminated any type of rural and farm character. And talking to communities, it's about options. So if you go to slide 92, you know, you can really cluster some of that development so that you still have good design. There's green space. There's the interconnected streets that Jeff talked about. There's different ways for traffic to move around. And you still have farms, whether it's for the character, whether it's for food production, it's still available to the community. And then if you really want to pack things in a little more, you could go to slide 93, kind of traditional neighborhood or creating a new village in that community, which, again, leaves some open space. And you can still see, you know, in the far background, you've got other options. I know we looked at that kind of corridor in Virginia where you still have people that want to live outside on the 5 to 10-acre lots. You know, those there's still some options available. And again, if we move to slide 94, we see a lot of this in Vermont where, you know, how do farmers subdivide and develop their land and still have farming available? And here in slide 94, you see that kind of traditional, conventional subdivision where the farm is basically gone. But if you move to slide 95, there you can see how you've got kind of clustered and tucked away those homes, and you still have the farmland available for production. So using these kind of visuals with a community shows that it's not about no. I mean, oftentimes we come in to talk to folks and they're saying, well, you are the folks that are about no growth. And once we kind of show them what we're talking about in terms of smart growth, they realize that they do have options available to them. And if you move to slide 96, something that I think is really important and really kind of helped me is looking at how do we create a message. And this slide was done for the Smart Growth Alliance by Action Media. And so often we go right to the issue. We talk about, you know, a building and you know, the pros and cons of that building, or we talk about saving a wetland, or we talk about the importance of an impaired waterway. And that's really key to us. But is that the message that's really going to resonate with the people in the community, with the decision makers, you know, within a regional context? And so what Action Media really is suggesting that you step back and you really talk and evoke those values. Well, what is the big picture? And kind of similar to what I said about asking community about what their goals are, they're going to really kind of give you the things that they care about. So when you're talking about big picture, talking about things like options, fairness, you know, what's the community benefit for the whole community? How do we ensure that there's good, strong participation? So if you say to folks, you know, don't you think that everyone in this community, you know, deserves housing, you know, safe, affordable housing? That's really a value that everyone kind of resonates with most people. And if you start there rather than a particular development project, it can often get you further than you think. Then looking, moving into kind of coming down from the value, moving into the context. You know, really what is that context? You know, it's a local process and we're talking about growth and development. And then you move to defining the issue. You know, we know that we need housing for folks. We know we need a variety of different housing options and a variety of different housing prices. How do we move that all together? If you move to slide 97, you can kind of see this using the values and the concepts that an audience understands, connecting with them, and then applying it to the issue that you're interested in really increases you know, your clarity of communication and can reach more people. Moving to slide 98, I think partnerships are really important. And looking at, you know, we've got EPA here today, those federal agencies that we can work at. There's a lot of different state agencies. We're looking to work with the Department of Tourism here in Vermont because they're really showing and starting to ask questions about why people come to Vermont, and it's really about landscape and how we manage that land. And if we can show that there is an economic engine behind smart growth and looking at those maintaining that settlement pattern, that can be a powerful partnership. Looking at other nonprofits, As I mentioned before, working with a group that has an alternative approach to you. So we often work with the Conservation Law Foundation because they do a lot of the kind of harder-edged work, and it's a different approach than we, but we work very cooperatively together to kind of move as the protection of land forward. Also working with groups with a different mission, like I mentioned before, looking at affordable housing, green building, historic preservation. We also look at building leaders. We have something called the Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, and those are businesses that are looking at that triple bottom line and, you know, bringing them into the conversation to say, you know, businesses can locate downtown and they can be very successful, can be very added voice to your discussion. We work with farmers, and one of those kind of different groups that we often work with is realtors. We've developed a course for realtors here, accreditation course, and we probably speak to 400 realtors, and those folks are often, you know, planning commission members and or developers. So helping them understand that and message for that market, helping them create a message for smart growth. And we're seeing nationally, as Jeff mentioned, that there's becoming more of a demand for the kind of dense in-town living close to amenities. And that's, you know, kind of helping realtors create that message is something that we see as an added bonus or as a new partnership to kind of carry our message forward. And if you go to slide 99, here are some kind of tips. I think it's really important that whoever you partner with or however you move forward, it's really clear. It's really good to be clear about your goals, what your roles are and what those expectations are, so that if you're working in partnership with a community, if you're supporting them, they understand what your goals are as well as how you can help them. And I think it's important to know when to walk away. If your goals and your partner's goals are not lining up, we are very explicit with the communities that we work with that, you know, at some point that they're interested in going off in a different direction that might not be implementing smart growth principles, that, you know, we might not be the best partner for them at that point, and we're very clear about that. I think it's important to really give credit and praise in the communities that we work with. It really is about, you know, their community work and letting folks know the great work that they're doing and the time that they're putting in into it. I think it's really important to know when to be a partner in a community and then also knowing when to advocate and really having a clear idea of when you're partnering with an organization and when you're going to advocate a position and how you do that. And I think if you're dealing with anyone that's dealt in the local or state or even regional, it's really to have patience, to understand that land use planning is a long-term process, and you need to kind of have patience and look for the small victories in what you're doing. So if you move to the last slide, this is just how you can reach me and a bit of an understanding about what smart growth does. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Noelle. We do have time for questions again. And if you move to slide 101, you'll see that we set aside some more time for that. First, I'm going to draw your attention to where you can obtain the speaker's contact information. If you're online, simply click on the Home button at the top of your screen, and you'll be returned to the seminar's homepage, which has the speaker's email addresses and phone numbers. If you want to go ahead and move to slide 102 now, again, for those of you participating online, please take a look at the left-hand sidebar. There is a links button which has additional resources identified for today's webcast. Also on the left-hand sidebar is the feedback button. Please take a quick minute or so to submit the online feedback form, as we really do consider your comments in our quest to improve our webcast. At this time, we will address audience questions, and we'll begin with those submitted online. And our first question comes from Jennifer in Oklahoma. And Jennifer asks, although historic preservation is smart growth, the Department of the Interior standards for rehab of historic structures is often contrary to energy efficiency, the use of new technology, and sustainable materials. How do you overcome this obstacle?
Here in Vermont, I know we've got folks, the green building and the preservation groups are working together, and it's interesting because most of the affordable housing development is that's done. They're the affordable housing groups here in Vermont are the biggest proponents and implementers of green building in the state. And often, because they have also the largest projects, they're doing historic rehab and energy efficiency. And they are kind of doing both together. I have not heard it's more expensive for them to do it, but that's been the only complaint that I've heard.
Okay, and our next question comes from Carl in Hawaii. Carl writes, Aloha from Maui. As we also are developing in active agricultural area, how does Smart Growth Vermont reconcile the conflicts between industrial, large-scale ag activities with adjacent compact residential communities?
We have some, our biggest agriculture here is dairy. And one of the things communities look at is how you develop buffer zones in between the two. And the ag land, one of the incentives in the Growth Center bill that we talked about was agricultural mitigation. So there was a lot of discussion that there are some areas that we should grow, and that's where we best place in terms of infrastructure and size, and they've allowed some agricultural mitigation there. There have not, it's the right to farm as well. They've got a state right to farm bill that really holds up that farming is important in those areas. And I know New Jersey does too, and I know New Jersey also has municipal right to farm ordinances to tell folks that move into those areas that farmers really do have that right. But in terms of large scale farms, we just don't have that here in Vermont.
And our next question comes from Jackie in Massachusetts. Jackie writes, do you think the Vermont Growth Center program is off to a good start? The first designated center is awfully big. Should growth centers be more narrowly defined?
Where was that caller from?
From Boston, Massachusetts.
Believe it or not, the first growth center that was proposed was double that size, and we worked to decrease the size of that growth center. But it really needs to be on a case-by-case basis. I think that the first growth center, which is Williston, which is where we actually have all the big boxes here in Vermont, the community realizes that it's not what they want in the future, and they're really trying to do some infill. And for their community, it makes sense. The second one that just came in, is their growth center is about 230 acres. So I think you're going to see different size and scale depending on what's already there. Some of the growth centers that are being proposed are larger, but they include a lot of areas for infill, and they wanted to have the incentives for those areas. So I think that while Williston is not what I would have as my poster child for growth centers, I think the community has done a good job at looking at how do they make interconnected streets, how do they add housing and other uses to really make that a more kind of vibrant area where people could work and live and play.
And our next question comes from Jennifer in Oklahoma. And Jennifer writes, would you please give us the web address for the online toolbox?
It will be available December 17th. It's going live. And if you go to smartgrowthvermont.org, you'll have a link on the front page.
Great. At this time, I am going to open the phone line so we can try and take a couple questions from them. Just as a reminder for those of you who are participating on the phone lines, I'm going to unmute everyone. So if you don't have a question, please remain muted so that we can hear the caller with the question. And again, if you do have a question, please just give us your name and organization before the question. Are there questions on the phone line?
Yes, there's a question here. Pascal Muse, EPA Region 9.
Go ahead.
All right. A question in general for Nancy Stoller and Nellie McKay. Now, we in this region obviously deal with a larger amount of desert areas, Arizona, Nevada, things of that nature, and whether there's any sort of green development tool that you're aware of that is optimized for that sort of drier climate. Green roofs aren't quite as applicable.
Hi, this is Nancy.
I think actually that can you hear me?
Yes,
Nancy, if you want to hang on 1 second, I'm going to go ahead and mute everyone and ask you to unmute yourself again. So if you want to go ahead and unmute yourself and address the question.
Okay, hopefully I'm back. I would say that that they actually do have some green roofs in lots of different places because, of course, green roofs are often sedum is used in them, and they are desert-like plants, ones that don't need watering and can stand in the baking sun. So there actually are some, I know, in at least in New Mexico and places like that. But the other thing about, you know, those areas is that the types of things we were talking about with rain barrels and cisterns and, you know, water reuse, of course, is such an important component, as well as ensuring that the water that does, the rainfall that does fall there, isn't being wasted. And so ensuring that it isn't being put in pipes, even in those areas, but it's being put back in the ground where it can recharge the aquifers is even more important where there is less water available. But there's lots of green infrastructure being used in California where there's very little water as well. I'm just not sure that there are as many communities that are as advanced in these techniques in Arizona and Nevada, not that I'm aware of, but I think that there's plenty of places, including Colorado, California, New Mexico, where they are in pretty widespread use. So I would encourage you to look into those.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and try and unmute us again. Again, callers or people participating on the phone, if you don't have a question, please mute yourself because it's getting really hard for us to hear. Is there a question from the phone? Are there any questions on the phone? Any questions? Okay. All right. We do have one more question from those online. And this comes from Jennifer in Oklahoma again. And Jennifer asks, what are your thoughts about USGBC's new lead ND? And again, you're going to have to unmute yourself, speakers, if you'd like to answer the question. Or we can give it to Jeff.
Lead ND is actually a project that my office, the Smart Growth Program at EPA, has had a large part in funding and working directly on. I think it's got a lot of potential to be very helpful. You know, once Smart Growth became sort of popularized and in the common parlance, you had a lot of projects coming forward saying, oh, this is a Smart Growth project, and obviously you need something to measure them against. And I don't think as I said in my presentation, I don't think it's smart growth or not. I think it's sort of degrees of smartness, basically, and that Lead ND does a good job of taking into account all of the different factors from location to design to how it handles stormwater to whether it's paying attention to sensitive lands and so forth. So I think it's a good tool. I think it's, you know, it's in the pilot stage. It has over 300 pilots that they're going to go through over the next year. That's going to work out a lot of the kinks and really, you know, put it through its paces with developments of a lot of different typologies. So I'm anxious to see what comes out of that. I do think that, you know, over the long term, it's another thing that is going to be sort of making changes in the development market. I don't see any reason to think that it won't go sort of in the same way that green buildings have, where localities have decided they want to create incentives for green buildings, where developers see some advantages in terms of marketing their buildings as green. I think they'll see the same advantages in marketing their communities as green. And I think that that eventually some places may even, you know, make carrots that are so big they end up being orange sticks, essentially. And just for people's reference, LEED is Leadership in Environmental Design or something to that effect. And it's a rating system for that's traditionally been associated with buildings. And one of the issues that I always thought was kind of problematic was that it didn't pay any attention to location. And so the chart that that Noel showed in terms of the effects of driving and the energy use associated with different locations of the building, I think are nicely addressed in the LEED ND standard. So it's a standard that essentially you can use to rate neighborhoods and neighborhood location and building location, as well as it's a useful addition to the LEED line of products that rate individual buildings.
Thank you, Jeff.
Can I jump in too?
Oh, yep, go ahead.
We've been actually following the LEED ND here to kind of see if we could implement it, and maybe Jeff, you can tell me where it has been implemented well. We have a kind of a smart growth housing endorsement already, so folks come with housing endorsements, and we have a whole set of criteria, and we're looking to the LEED ND to kind of expand it, to kind of provide a local stamp of approval, and we also, the groups in that collaborative that I mentioned, go and help those developers in various local and statewide regulatory proceedings and process. So that's kind of one way we're thinking about taking the LEED ND and seeing if we can adapt it and utilize it to kind of move good projects forward.
This is Nancy. I'll join in too. NRDC, my colleague here, Kate Benfield, was the co-chair of the LEED ND group, and I agree very much with what Jeff had to say, that it's terrific that LEED ND is looking at broader than the building footprint, but a whole neighborhood or community design kind of thing, which was sorely needed in the green building industry. EPA, Jeff and I and a number of other organizations and individuals work to create some, I guess there's two different tracks for stormwater control standards in LEED ND that people might want to take a look at. And we are trying to encourage people to use LEED ND, the approach that came out, I believe, in June, as an alternative that looks at on-site retention of water as obtaining credits under LEED ND, which it will be great for people who haven't looked at those kinds of retention approaches as opposed to sort of the more traditional approaches of either getting stormwater off the site rapidly or just detaining it for a short time and then releasing it. So I also found the name of the document I was looking for earlier when someone asked me about economics. Well, there's a new EPA report, Reducing Stormwater Costs Through Low-Impact Development Strategies and Practices, which I served as a peer reviewer for, and that has a lot of good information also for the caller that was looking for economic information.
Thank you very much. This does conclude today's Watershed Academy webcast. And on behalf of the entire EPA Watershed Academy webcast team, I would like to take this time to thank Jeffrey Anderson, Nancy Stoner, Noel McKay, Kate O'Mara, and Jamal Qadri for their help with this webcast. And, of course, thanks to every one of you who joined us. This is Megan Klasick from EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds signing off. Have a great day and happy holidays.